Hello and welcome to Crowd Science from the BBC World Service, the show that scours the land for answers to your science questions, every week, rain or shine. I'm Anand Jagatia, and this week we've got a whole bunch of brilliant questions on one of the most popular topics in our inbox, the weather. Weather affects all of us in ways big and small, which is probably why so many people around the world love chatting about it. With me in the studio is Chief Executive of the Royal Meteorological Society, Professor Liz Bentley. Thanks very much for joining us, Liz. Is it easier or harder to talk about the weather in small talk because you're an actual meteorologist?
No, it's easy. I mean, I'm obsessed by the weather, as I guess a lot of people are around the world. One thing people just assume, because you're a meteorologist, you know what the weather's going to do absolutely anywhere in the world at any time, and I don't know everything.
Yeah, no, you're not their personal weather correspondent. And we also have down the line from Switzerland, where he is Director of Infrastructure at the World Meteorological Organization, Dr. Anthony Ray, who was formerly Chief Data Officer at the Australian Bureau of Meteorology. Bit of a mouthful. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how are you going?
Brilliant. Thanks for joining us. I suppose weather and climate are actually a much more serious topic of conversation at the moment back home in Australia.
Absolutely. I came to Switzerland just as the fires were ramping up in Australia, but they've had a bit of everything. I mean, the fires have been devastating, and over the last week there's been incredibly heavy rainfall, which has, it's put some of the fires out, which is great, but it's led to some quite devastating flash flooding as well.
Almost couldn't get any worse. Well, we'll be returning to wildfires later on in the show, and thank you very much, both of you, for joining us. Now on to the weather where you are. Our first question comes from listener Tamara, who is actually here with us in real life in the studio. Hi, Tamara.
Hi, hello.
This is a bit of a treat. We don't often get Crowd Science listeners in with us, so it's really a pleasure to have you.
I know, I feel very honoured.
So tell us where you're from and what your question is.
So I am Spanish, but I live in London. And my question is, how do we forecast the weather, and what's the weirdest weather that's been forecasted?
That's a really great question to start us off. Thanks very much, Tamara. So Liz, let's come to you for the first part of that. Mm-hmm. How do we actually forecast the weather these days?
There are three things, I guess, to make a weather forecast. The first is we need to understand what the weather's doing now. We need lots of observations. We take over 200 million observations around the world every day. And that comes from all sorts of land observations, people who have thermometers and rain gauges, and we're taking measurements, satellite data. We're getting radiosondes that take data from the atmosphere as you go up in a weather balloon. So all sorts of data coming in, and we collect that and we share that with all the different countries around the world. And then we need a numerical model. So we model the atmosphere. We have all these mathematical equations that describe what the atmosphere is doing. And we run this model, and it's very complicated. So we need a supercomputer to run that model, big supercomputer. And then it produces a forecast for a day ahead or a week ahead or however far ahead we want to go. And then you need a person to look at that data, to analyze it and to make some assumptions as to how well the forecast has coped with that weather situation. Even though we've got supercomputers that are fantastic and great models that can predict the forecast of what the weather's going to do, you still need a person in the mix to take that forecast and then communicate it.
It's kind of obvious, but I never thought of how much of a global kind of enterprise it is, because you need to know what the weather's doing everywhere to work out what the weather's doing in one place.
That's right. So we have global models. We have regional models as well, but they need the global models to drive, I guess, the boundary conditions in the regional model. And certainly, I've been forecasting or involved with forecasting for 25 years. The scale that we're looking at has got finer and finer and finer over that time. And the models are looking on about a 1 kilometre scale. So we can get down to some really fine detail of what the weather's doing now. And hence the accuracy of the forecasts has gone up because our models have improved.
Yeah. So this is huge amounts of data, you know, millions of observations, trillions of calculations. Anthony, can you tell us a bit more about the kind of number crunching that we need to create something on this sort of scale? So these are supercomputers, right? How big and how powerful do they need to be?
These are supercomputers, and they're the type of thing that will take up, you know, a whole floor of a building or a very big, you know, actually these days they're generally located in dedicated data centres. These are petascale machines, so I'll try and get this right. So a megaflop would be a million calculations a second, then a teraflop's 1,000 times that, and then a petaflop is 1,000 times that. And actually, now we're talking about moving into exascale computing, which is 1,000 times bigger again. So these are very large, and in fact, there's a kind of ranking table of these supercomputers globally, and quite often the biggest ones are the ones that are operated by these global numerical weather prediction centres.
there can't be many of them around the world, right?
In terms of global centres, there's maybe 12 or 13.
Amazing. Well, thanks, Anthony. That's the basics of weather forecasting. Easy. So tomorrow, what are your thoughts? Was that what you were expecting?
Yeah, no. I thought it would be a lot simpler. That sounds very complicated.
So tomorrow, the second part of your question was about what the weirdest weather is that's ever been forecasted or been observed. Is there a reason specifically why you're interested in that?
I just think it's interesting, you know. There's so many aspects to the weather. I bet there's been like something that nobody was expecting, even though the statistics were saying this is going to happen. And then something completely unexpected happened, and then all the meteorologists were like, what?
Yeah, I mean, I'm easy to please. If it snows in April or something, I'll lose my mind. Anthony, can we start with you? What's the weirdest weather that you've come across?
Lenticular clouds are one that came to mind. When there's wind blowing over a hill or a mountain, you can get these clouds, and they are quite striking. They have the appearance of a kind of a UFO. They can be dome-shaped, and there can be multiple levels. And this is a rare but not completely uncommon phenomenon, so you can go to places and see these. Just coming from Melbourne, I guess, you know, we kind of pride ourselves on the variability of our weather. You can have a very hot day in Melbourne, maybe over 40 degrees Celsius, and then a cold front will come through and the temperature will drop more than 20 degrees in a matter of minutes. So this can be quite unsettling if you haven't brought a coat or an umbrella. And Melbourne just had actually another really weird event just recently. There was a dust storm with all of the hot weather and the drought. There was an enormous amount of dust lifted into the atmosphere, and it coincided with a thunderstorm over Melbourne, and they ended up with this kind of rain of red sludge, and it turned the footpaths red, it turned people's swimming pools red. It was really quite incredible.
Yeah, terrifying stuff. I think, speaking of these kind of dust storms, I saw some images kind of circulating online of these huge kind of cliff faces almost of dust that were just sweeping over these plains in Australia. I mean, just engulfing everything in their path.
I can remember one when I was a kid, actually, in Melbourne. I was in the mid-80s, and this wall of red dust came, and I had no interest in meteorology at the time, and you know, it was kind of apocalyptic, and no, I didn't know what it was, you know. It was kind of terrifying, actually.
What about you, Liz?
I guess we're all familiar with lightning, but there's something called red sprites that come out of the top of thunderstorm clouds. So lightning normally is from the bottom of the cloud and comes down to ground. So they can be blue ones as well, blue sprites, but typically red, and they come out of the top of a thunderstorm cloud. So typically aren't seen by us on the ground, but pilots will see them if they're flying around. They'll see these kind of sparks coming out of the top of a thunderstorm cloud. Linked with lightning, there's something called ball lightning. So these are kind of static balls of atmospheric electricity that float around. So they're very rare to see, but they float in the air, and they can last sometimes for minutes. They can float through a window into a building. There's certainly some in literature going back hundreds of years where one went into a church and exploded and everybody thought it was a message from God. And, but they can be the size of a kind of, I don't know, tennis ball, or up to 2 metres wide. So
wow.
They can be huge things, and they just float around, and they're linked with the effects of lightning, but rather than having the kind of fork lightning that we traditionally see, it's a ball of kind of glowing light.
I mean, how does that even sustain itself? Why doesn't it just kind of instantly...
Well, good question, because I think they are so rare, they're very difficult to replicate in a kind of laboratory situation. So it's very difficult to know exactly what causes them, why certain conditions will lead to ball lightning. So that's ball lightning. I had another one, which is probably more to do with the wind, the strength of the wind. So we've had some recently. We had some off the coast of Spain. There was a big storm that hit the Balearic Islands, and then it came up towards Barcelona and the coastline there. And the winds can really whip up the seas, and they get this kind of mixing going that then forms a foam that starts to develop on top of the sea, and then that can get brought onshore with the wind. And you get these kind of a foot or a couple of feet deep of foam just being kind of penetrating inland. So lots of strange things. And even things like, I mean, you've heard the term raining cats and dogs. Well, there have been reports of frogs or fish that fall from the sky in storms
as
well.
And so that's just, they're literally, the force of the storm is just picking them up and then just chucking them down somewhere
else.
Yeah,
so it's usually the updraft, the air that's been drawn up into the storm will lift things off the ground or out of a lake or out of the sea and then drop them somewhere else.
I actually quite like the idea of sea foam. Wouldn't be surprised if you saw that in some hipster restaurants in London next week. That's like the weirdest weather I've definitely heard of, lightning balls. Tamara, has that answered your question?
Yep.
Great. Well, next up is a question that I'd actually never thought about before, but I think is really fascinating, and it comes from listener Alice.
Hi, Crowd Science. I'm Alice, and I'm calling from San Francisco, California, in the US, where I'm travelling for work. But I live in a small village in Hampshire, in the UK. I was on holiday in Australia late last year and got caught in a rainstorm while out driving. The raindrops were enormous. I've never encountered rain like this at home in the UK. So what I'd like to know is what dictates the size of raindrops? Are they always bigger or smaller in certain parts of the world? Thanks for answering my question.
Thanks very much, Alice. So before we get into Alice's question about raindrops, first of all, something we should definitely touch on before we do is the difference between weather and climate. So Liz, can you give us a distinction there?
In simple terms, weather is what we get in the short term here and now, so it might be today or the next few days. And climate is what we get over longer periods of time. So typically we'd look over maybe 2 or 3 decades to kind of see what the climate looks like. And a good analogy of this is your wardrobe. So your clothes in your wardrobe. So you can imagine if you live in a cool climate, your wardrobe's going to be full of lots of kind of winter jumpers and coats, and that's your kind of climate. But you will choose what you're going to wear today depending on what the weather's going to do. So actually, if the temperature is a little bit warm, you might just put one layer on, but if it's quite cold, then you might put a thicker jumper on or a jacket. So the wardrobe itself is the climate, and what you choose to wear today is the weather. Does that help?
Yeah, let's say you live in a place that generally has a cool climate, the wardrobe will mainly reflect that, but occasionally you might get a warm day and then you'll wear clothes for warm weather.
Yeah, or a cold day and you might need to put a jumper on or a couple of extra layers. But your wardrobe or your climate is typically what you would expect to get for that particular part of the world.
Okay, well, thanks for clearing that up. So now that we've got to the bottom of that, let's talk about raindrops. So Anthony, I didn't even know that we got raindrops of different sizes in different parts of the world. What determines how big they are? So I kind of just assumed that it would be the same everywhere, but apparently not.
We tend to get bigger raindrops in convective systems, so in big thunderstorms. So as Liz mentioned before, we get an updraft in the thunderstorm so that the rain's falling out of the cloud, but it's getting lifted up in the core of the cloud. And this process might happen many, many times. And in fact, if it's cold enough in the cloud, it will turn into hail and precipitate as hail. But the raindrops can aggregate over time, and so they'll get larger and larger. And so from these convective storms, you can get these quite enormous raindrops. And, you know, you'll experience that in the tropical areas of the world, but also in temperate areas where you have these large storms.
So how big can a raindrop get?
Oh, I don't know. I might be straying into Liz's territory here.
Yeah, Liz, what would you say?
I think what's interesting, actually, we often think the shape of a raindrop is that classic drop shape. So narrow at the top and then kind of bulging at the bottom. And we draw that as children, I guess, when we're doing pictures of raindrops. But the raindrop is different. So it's kind of flat. It looks almost like a kidney shape. So it's slightly narrow in the middle and then bulges to the outside. So again, it's not a circle or it's not that kind of classic raindrop shape. You're probably looking maybe, I don't know, a millimetre across, something like that.
It doesn't sound that big, but is there actually just quite a lot of liquid in there? So Alice's question referred to these huge raindrops. Does it just feel big when it hits you in the face?
Yeah, exactly. And also you've got the size of the raindrop, but then the amount of raindrops that are falling all at the same time. I guess if you're in a really torrential downpour, even with smaller raindrops, it's going to feel like everything's a lot wetter because you've just got so much falling from the sky.
Our next question is about the extremely complex phenomenon known as Murphy's Law, which says that if something can go wrong, it probably will. It encompasses everything from scratching your car the day your insurance runs out to things like having a week of gorgeous, beautiful, sunny weather while you're stuck in the office, and then it gets to the weekend and it rains the whole time.
Hello, Crowd Science. I'm Aidan and I'm calling from Chippenham in England. I'd like to know why the weather seems nice during the working week while many of us are stuck in our office at work, and then it rains at the weekend when we're at home. Do our working patterns affect the weather, or is it all in our heads?
So Liz, is this just Murphy's Law, or is it down to just how we're perceiving and remembering things, or can our working patterns actually have an effect on the weather?
I think part of it is our perception. So we kind of maybe concentrate on what the forecast is going to be like at the weekend because we want to do more and go out and enjoy it. And then when we can't, it kind of sticks in our mind. But I think a lot of that is perception and how we remember, I guess, the more negative effects. But there have been some studies that have looked at rainfall on particular days of the week. And I was looking back at a study that was done in Manchester in the UK. Now, Manchester is quite renowned for being a wet city in the UK. People often say it always rains in Manchester. So there was lots of data. They looked at the last 110 years of rainfall data in Manchester. So they went back a long time and they looked at the rainfall on different days. And it came out with the following. So Tuesday was the wettest day of the week.
Always hated Tuesdays.
Yeah, exactly. But closely followed by Sundays. So, you know, not the whole of the weekend, but Sunday itself.
And Liz, was this just like tiny amounts?
It didn't actually look at amounts of rainfall. Basically, it said, did it rain or didn't it rain? But it did notice a few changes in how patterns had changed over time as well. So it did notice that it's raining more now at weekends than it did in the past. There'd been a 10% increase in the chance of rain happening at the weekend than maybe if you go back 30 years or so.
10% is loads. That's rubbish.
Quite a lot. No, exactly.
Do we know why that is? Is it potentially because there's more going on during the week?
So the study was trying to look at this. So it was trying to see if the impact of people driving into the city or traffic going into the city and industry maybe putting more pollution into the atmosphere in the kind of weekdays, whether that had an impact on the weather, either in the weekdays or at the weekend. And there wasn't really any conclusive evidence. You know, you would think if you've got lots of pollution particles in the atmosphere, they can act as little cloud condensation nuclei and raindrops can form. And so I think they were trying to hope there was a link between maybe the amount of pollution from industry or traffic might mean that we get more rainfall during certain times of the week. So there was no correlation that came from that particular thing.
You're listening to Crowd Science from the BBC World Service, and today we're expecting sunny spells, highs of 24 degrees Celsius, some light winds from the east, and questions from around the world. This week, all on the subject of weather. Now, so far we've talked about seasonal and weekly weather, but listener Mark would like to know about something on the scale of a day. Are there more hours of sunshine in the morning or in the afternoon?
Hi Crowd Science, I'm Mark and I'm calling you from Phnom Penh in Cambodia. I'd like to know, are there more hours of sunshine in the morning or the afternoon? I'm interested as I wonder if this information might help us make decisions about planting crops so they get more sunlight. I also wondered if it might affect how we build houses, so they keep us as warm or as cool as necessary. How much difference is there between morning and afternoon sunlight?
Great question. Thanks, Mark. So, Liz, is there much of a difference between morning and afternoon sunlight?
We've got two terms here. We've got sunlight and sunshine. And I think it's worth just distinguishing what the difference is between those. So sunlight or daylight happens obviously from sunrise in the morning till sunset in the evening. And that can change from season to season or day to day, depending where you are in the world. And it's nothing really to do with the weather. Obviously, as soon as the sun rises, you get sunlight through the day and then it'll sunset and it stops. So you can tell how long you're going to get. Sunshine is related to how much of that solar radiation actually reaches the ground. So we need to start thinking about how much cloud is in the sky that will prevent that sunlight from reaching the ground. And as meteorologists, we are interested in the amount of sunlight, but we particularly measure sunshine. If I focus on sunshine, so obviously it depends whether cloud is around. I guess you've got two prevailing weather patterns. Sometimes you wake up in the morning, beautiful blue skies, the sun is out. And then as the day goes on, those clouds start to bubble up. We call them fair weather clouds, but they start to just block out a bit of that sunshine. So the morning will be sunnier than the afternoon. The opposite of that is the prevailing weather where you wake up in the morning and there's a low layer of cloud, maybe some low mist, a bit of fog, and then the sun burns that cloud away, and then by late morning, lunchtime, beautiful blue sky. So in the morning, obviously with that low cloud, there's less sunshine, but in the afternoon you get more sunshine. So the weather can have a real impact whether mornings are more sunny than the afternoons.
Okay, either of those things could happen. Yeah. It just depends on what the weather systems are doing at that
time
of year. Okay, great. Mark was also interested in whether there are any practical implications of this, so whether knowing about the hours of sunlight could affect how we build houses to keep warm or cool and what kind of crops we plant. Anthony, could we use that data in a meaningful way?
Yeah, we could, and we do. Coming from Australia, there's a huge demand for data about how much sunlight and sunshine there is, so how much direct and indirect solar radiation there might be at any part of the planet. We talked a little bit before about the global observing system for weather, but we also have instruments that are operated by Met Services and other agencies that measure the amount of sunlight. And this is important. You know, it's important for engineers when they're designing buildings and wanting to understand the heat loads on those buildings. It's important for architects when they're looking at overshadowing and those types of considerations in town planning. There's a massive demand now and a growing demand for data from the solar energy industry. So if they're planning to put a solar plant, or indeed if you're planning to put a solar panel on your house, you need to know how much sunlight you're going to get.
Okay, so it can be really useful. Liz, do you have something to add?
Yeah, so I mean, again, you can look at different buildings around the world. So, you know, you take buildings in Greece, for example, they're painted white. They reflect that sunlight away. And that's, you know, the way of keeping the temperatures down within the building itself. And Tamara and I were chatting before we came into the studio. So Tamara's from Spain. I'm from the UK and you live in the UK now. But we were just commenting, in Spain in summer, the windows are closed, the shutters are closed, there's no sunlight allowed inside the building. It's trying to keep the building as cool as possible during daylight. In the UK, when the sun's out, we fling the windows open and we just get hotter and hotter. We don't know how to cope with it.
So as soon as there's a glimpse of sunshine in England, everyone's taking their tops off, instantly going down to the park, get an ice cream, walk the dog. Does that chime with your experiences then tomorrow? When it's hot, you just keep the windows closed?
Yes. So the moment the sun is out in Spain, you close all the windows, open them at night, of course, let that breeze in. But the moment the sun is out, close everything off. No sun is allowed inside because you'll just boil to death.
Yeah, I remember like when there was a heat wave a couple of years ago, people were saying during the day, just keep your curtains closed. And mm-hmm. that's the best way to kind of keep mm-hmm. the building cool. Thanks very much, Anthony and Liz. Our next question comes from father and son duo, Paul and Edward here in the UK. And they've been having a chat about the seasons and would like to know how the distance from the equator affects how many seasons people have. Liz, first of all, what are the seasons? They're not all the same all around the world, are they?
Depending where you are from the equator to the pole, either north or south pole, you will get different seasons. Some places will see just maybe two seasons a year. They might have a wet season and a dry season, for example. Lots of places have the typical four seasons, so spring, summer, autumn and winter, where you get kind of prevailing weather patterns that tend to happen during those four seasons. And they're what we call the mid-latitudes. So as the Earth moves around the sun, the position of the Earth means our daylight hours are shorter or longer, and we get these different seasons. So four seasons for many people. But the closer to the equator you get, the seasons just completely disappear. In fact, there are no seasons. There are places on Earth where the weather is pretty much the same every day. You can even almost set your watch to when you're going to get shower clouds bubbling in the afternoon and you get that torrential downpour at 2 p.m. every afternoon. So predicting the weather in places like that is quite easy.
Just a cinch,
and
yeah.
I think as a meteorologist would become quite dull.
Yep.
I think most of us enjoy those kind of seasonal changes, but there are places in the world that don't get seasons.
Just following on from what Liz was saying, four seasons is kind of a Western construct. It's a physical construct in terms of where the Earth is in relation to the sun. But the Bureau of Meteorology did an Indigenous weather project where they looked at kind of traditional knowledge of the Indigenous inhabitants of Australia. And in some areas, I think in Northern Australia, you know, there were maybe 11 seasons that were defined. And it might be defined as, you know, this is when the eels start coming down the creek or something, you know. So I think it's partially a cultural construct as well. And, you know, there are certainly parts of Australia, in Northern Australia, where from a Western perspective, we'd say, well, there's two seasons, there's wet season and there's dry season.
I think, again, people are very much interested in the growing season. So when the temperature gets above about 5 degrees, things start to grow. And that certainly has extended. As we've seen a warmer climate, that growing season has extended. So we're interested, I guess, as meteorologists with the traditional seasons, but people will view seasons depending on what sector they're considering. And we've certainly seen some change in the length of season. So I guess the wildfire season in Australia, again, Anthony, is probably something we're seeing a change. It's becoming an extended season because of the increase in temperature.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. And, you know, what we're hearing reported from the fire agencies and the land managers is that there's also less time available in the year where they can do the kind of fuel reduction burning that they would normally have done to kind of keep the loads down. So that in turn kind of exacerbates the problem.
Our next question comes from someone who lived through an event that was top of the World Service News on the 29th of July, 2018.
Hi, Crowd Science. I'm Barbara from Redding, California. Our town was hit by a devastating wildfire in 2018 and was blanketed by smoke and ash for months. My question for you is, does smoke and ash from wildfires affect the weather?
Thousands of people are evacuated from California as wildfires rage across the United States. fire everywhere on both sides of the roads. There's houses coming down, houses that were already down. To me, it kind of looked like an apocalyptic horror film. It was crazy.
I've lived in this area for most of my life, and we have fires every summer. But this fire was like no other fire that we had had. I mean, normally when we have fires, maybe a few homes are lost, but they really kind of keep it typically to just vegetation. And so when this fire started, like, I wasn't even worried. Like, I'm like, this is just normal summer behavior. We'll be fine. And it just was so out of control, and it just moved into our city, and it was just crazy. I had evacuated to the upper part of the city, and I went to a parking lot, and I'm looking toward the west at the lower part of the city, and it just looked like the whole city was on fire. I've never experienced something like that, and I experience fires every summer. So I would say definitely there is a link to climate change, for sure.
Barbara is not the only listener who has been asking us about wildfires. We've had lots of questions from listeners all around the world who are worried about them, so we're hoping to devote a whole episode of Crowd Science to wildfires in the future. Do listen out for it. Barbara also has other reasons for asking about a link between wildfire smoke and weather. As she mentioned, she and her family managed to evacuate the fire, and after about a week, they were allowed to go home. Unfortunately, they hadn't lost anything. But afterwards, things weren't the same.
There was just so much smoke for so long. And my children, their school put some kind of device that would test the air every day. And if the air got to a certain level of toxicity, school would be canceled. So they ended up having to go later into summer to make up for bad air quality days.
Oh, wow. So the air was so bad that it wasn't even safe to let the kids sort of out.
Yeah, school would be canceled because of air quality.
So your question is about how the fire might have affected the weather. Did you notice any changes in the weather around where you lived in the kind of months and weeks after the fire?
Yes, and that's what prompted the question. So in February of 2019, we had a really bad snowstorm, which we don't really get snowstorms here where I live. So snowstorms are rare. And then this one had really wet, heavy snow. I would say several parts of the city shut down because there were just so many trees down and power outages for a few days.
So it sounds like pretty extreme weather conditions that not really something that you kind of guys are used to, are there?
Yeah, and it was just wet, heavy snow. So that was in February. And then in spring, we just had so much rain. We have this creek that goes through our property. Most of the time it's dry, like it's just barely a 2 foot wide little creek. And we had this heavy rainstorm, and this 2 foot creek turned into like 20 foot wide, and it was just crazy. And we just had a lot of rain, and those events were like, wow, does this have something to do with all the smoke and the ash that was in the air?
So was the weather that Barbara experienced linked to the wildfire? To find out, we spoke to atmospheric chemist Dr. Rebecca Buchholz, a project scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado, USA. I started by asking if we know how high the pollution levels actually got just after the series of large wildfires that occurred across California in 2018, including the car fire that struck Barbara's town.
Yeah, we definitely know that the pollution from the fires in that year was really, really high. And some days it was higher than what we see in places like Delhi and Beijing, which are known for really bad air pollution. And so it was really worrying in that particular situation that we were getting such high pollution as well.
Worse pollution than some of the most polluted cities on Earth. Not good news. Although it is thought that smoke from wildfires could be quite different to pollution from cars or factories, and so might affect our health differently. But could there have been enough of it in the atmosphere to affect the weather?
One of the main components of driving the weather are these large-scale climate processes. But if the large-scale climate process is impacting the fires, it could also potentially be impacting the weather that we see from the fires as well.
Okay, so can we unpick that a bit? So basically, it's hard to tell whether this one isolated fire or this set of fires caused the specific snowfall that Barbara is talking about, but they could both have been driven by the same underlying processes in the first place.
Right. There's definitely a potential climate process link between the fires and the weather that could have been created afterwards. And like you said, it's really difficult to determine whether this specific fire event impacted this specific weather event. But we do know that fires can impact the weather. The particles that get emitted from the fires can impact cloud formation, for example. The particles become little condensation nuclei for water to condense on and become clouds.
Okay, so they get them up into the atmosphere and then the clouds form around those.
Right.
But this fire kind of happened in summer and the snowstorm happened the following winter in January. Although the fire did actually keep burning, it was kind of boundaried and contained until about January. So do you know whether it's feasible for that amount of rain to have been caused by the particles you would get from a fire like that?
Well, what we saw from the emissions from these fires is they were transported east across the country. So the particles that were emitted into the air were actually transported away, a lot of them. The other thing that happens with particles is they fall out of the atmosphere quite quickly, tends to be around maybe 2 weeks or so that they stay in the atmosphere. And so in terms of producing this much rainfall, it's hard to say exactly how the link would be between this particular fire and the rainfall. But that would be a very interesting question to put into our climate chemistry models and look at.
And what are some other ways in which big fires can influence weather events? So, I mean, one obvious way is that the landscape changes a lot, right? There used to be lots of trees. Now there aren't lots of trees anymore. Is there any way in which that could affect local weather?
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely a way that, for example, if you burn all of the fuel that's on the ground, you burn the trees, there's no longer leaves on the trees, you're changing the albedo on the ground, meaning the reflectivity. And so what used to be a really dark surface and potentially absorbing a lot of sunlight and heat is now reflecting a lot of sunlight and heat. And so you would get more of a colder surface because of that change in albedo.
That's kind of locally in the California area. But what about larger scale picture? So you said that the particulates did spread across the rest of the US. I mean, can smoke from wildfires affect weather, you know, in places that are much more distant?
It can definitely impact weather, but also air quality distant to where the fires are burning. So, for example, we saw impact here in Colorado from the West Coast fires. In both 2017 and 2018, we saw really bad air pollution locally here in Colorado.
I mean, my knowledge of US states isn't great. Like, roughly how far are we talking between those places?
So between, say, the West Coast and Denver is about a 4-hour flight.
Okay, wow. So like halfway across America, basically.
Right, yeah. And further, it went all the way to the East Coast of the US.
Thanks to Rebecca Buchholz. So for our final question, listener Alberto wants to know about a potential solution to wildfires.
Hola, Crowd Science. I'm Alberto da Silva and I'm calling from Santa Rita de Minas in Brazil. I've seen the recent wildfires in California, in the Amazon, and now in Australia on the news. It seems to me that these are a warning call for us all to take action. I also wondered if any weather-based solutions are being developed. For example, is there any way we could make rain to put out the fires?
Thanks, Alberto. So, Liz, first of all, is it actually possible for us to make it rain?
Yeah, so it's something called weather modification where we intentionally try and do something to the atmosphere to make it do something. So, for example, cloud seeding is one particular activity where you can make it rain. And this works by putting... So aircraft will either put chemicals into the atmosphere or rockets get fired up into the air to put these chemicals into the atmosphere. So chemicals such as things like silver iodide or just plain table salt can be put up in the atmosphere. And these act like small cloud condensation nuclei. As we've mentioned this a couple of times during the interview. And so that any moisture in the atmosphere condenses onto this little particle and it forms a raindrop and then eventually these fall out of the sky. So, yep, these things things have happened. They've been used with some limited success. I think any sort of weather modification, you really have to take heed that if you're going to try and change the atmosphere to do something, it'll probably have some negative consequence somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really sound like a great idea from where I'm standing, because surely if you affect the weather in one place, it's going to change it somewhere else. So, and then also you could get into a situation where one place might want it to rain and then they're stealing rain from other people.
Yeah, exactly. There is a famous event. So if you go back to the Beijing Olympics a few years ago, the Chinese government fired hundreds of rockets up to try and make it rain somewhere else than Beijing. They wanted the opening ceremony to be dry. So they fired these hundreds of rockets over the suburbs of Beijing, slightly outside. Torrential rain for the suburbs, and Beijing itself stayed dry during the opening ceremony. So, you know, there's success. I mean, whether it was a bit of luck as well as the kind of modification that they were trying to do, but there have been some kind of high profile events where this kind of weather modification has happened and seems to have had some success.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the weather normally is it's this great leveller, right? We can all talk about it. You can talk to, you know, a king or a queen about what the weather's like, because it affects everyone. But if you're going to start meddling with it, then you get into a whole different kind of situation.
Yeah, meddle with it at your peril.
Yeah, wise words there from Liz. Well, I think that's a good point to end on. That brings us to the end of the weather from Crowd Science. People talk about four seasons in one day. We've done that and a whole lot more in one show. Thank you very much to Professor Liz Bentley and Dr. Anthony Ray for your excellent expertise throughout today's show, and also to Rebecca Buchholz. I hope we've shone some light on everybody's questions and given you all plenty of material for small talk about the weather. So Tamara, thanks again for coming in. It's over to you to read out the credits.
That's it for this edition of Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. Today's questions were from a whole bunch of people all around the world. The presenter was Anandja Gatia and the producer was Jenwin T. If you have a question that science might be able to answer, please send it to crowdscience@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
Bye! Hi, me again. Just to say that if you didn't know, now we're going back to the moon.
Last year, the BBC World Service told the story of the first moon landing.
That's one small step for man.
We did it. We did it.
And now, 13 Minutes to the Moon returns with the real story of Apollo 13, a dramatic rescue mission from the depths of space.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
We're not going to the moon anymore. We're going to just be damn lucky to get home.
13 Minutes to the Moon, Season 2, coming soon. Search for 13 Minutes to the Moon to hear more.